Summertime and a living, this is it.
It's summer. Time to travel to a beautiful location, relax, and enjoy some music. Which apparently is what all of the classical musicians do, because we can't find any to do classical classroom episodes in town. So, we headed to the hills. And lo, we discovered there are these magical musical oases, whatever, called classical music festivals. Every summer, students, performers, and orchestras spend their supposed time off making yet more music. Each year, a classical classroom is going to highlight a different festival. This year, we traveled to sunny Santa Barbara, California, to the Music Academy of the West. So chill out, hang ten, insert other surfer phrases, and enjoy this Classical Classroom Summer Music Festival series. Hey listeners, welcome to the third installment of our Summer Music Festival series. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with composer, conductor, and pianist Matthew O'Coyne. It's true that part of the reason that we're doing this series on summer classical music festivals is, as we say in the intro of the show, that we're following the talent. But the other reason we're doing it is to find out why these things are so important to classical musicians. And I think we're getting closer to figuring it out. So let's have a little recap of what we've learned from our Music Academy of the West Spirit Guides. We've learned, as Music Academy of the West President and CEO Scott Reed says, that fellows go to the festival to practice performing. Fellow is, by the way, just what they call the students that go to the festival because they're all there on fellowships.
The idea is that in between school years, our fellows can join us and can focus exclusively on music making, technique, and performing in front of a live audience, which is something that we do quite extensively at the Music Academy.
Matthew Sinnoh, who's a viola fellow at the festival, says that in addition to learning how to be better performers, people go to these festivals for professional development, to make connections with others in their industry.
Just playing an orchestra isn't enough to keep you challenged and motivated and really keep you passionate about music. So these are the years you have to be going to festivals like Music Academy of the West, where you're meeting new people, making colleagues, making friends, and just finding who you like to play with. And that way, when you're sitting in an orchestra, and 10 years from now, maybe sitting in the section of San Diego Symphony, you'll be able to take weeks off. You know, you'll go to Seattle 1 week and you'll play a chamber music concert with your friends, or maybe you're playing a concerto somewhere else, or maybe your friend started a music festival. So these are the people we're going to be surrounded with for the rest of our lives.
And as faculty clarinet Richie Hawley says, musicians go to these festivals to learn. They attend these master classes, basically one-on-one learning in front of other people. A musician gets on stage with an expert musician, and the expert teaches him or her how to do things better. And at the Music Academy of the West, in addition to drawing tons of students, these masterclasses draw tons of audience members from the community. Sounds incredibly nerve-wracking, right?
In a masterclass, it's the traditional sense where you have a master teacher and working with a student on a stage and then with an audience that's participating and watching this event. And that's what's so spectacular about a festival like the Music Academy of the West, where it's really part of the community, and the community is part of the festival in how the audience participates in the education of all of these fellows.
In this interview with Matthew O'Coyne, we talk about a smaller fourth reason for attending summer music festivals: doing a residency. And even though I've talked about residencies on this show before, I realized that I actually had no idea what the term meant with regard to classical musicians. Big surprise, since I know so much about this stuff. Matthew explains what residents like him do at summer music festivals, and he introduces us to some of the very cool new music that he's been working on. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today is Matthew O'Coin. He's a composer, conductor, writer, and pianist. Coming up this fall, he's going to be artist in residence at the Los Angeles Opera, a position created just for him. In addition to his new commissioned works that will be premiering this coming season, he's recently made his conducting debut at the Music Academy of the West. His work has been performed by the likes of Yo-Yo Ma, and he's currently composer in residence at the Peabody Essex Museum. Matthew O'Coin, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
It's great to be here.
So let's get right to it. So tell us what you've been doing at the Music Academy of the West this summer.
Well, I'm a bit of a rare breed in that I really like composing and performing and treating it all as one activity. And what's really great about my work at the Music Academy this summer is that they've been willing to embrace this goulash of musical things that I like to do. So we started the summer by performing my chamber opera, Second Nature. Mm-hmm. And now I'm conducting a much older piece, Smetana's opera, The Bartered Bride. Mm-hmm. And alongside that, you know, coaching the singers and working with also the instrumental fellows about different styles of music and diction and musical issues. And it's a real treat for me.
So before we get into the music, which I'd like to do, actually, we were lucky enough to get a copy of your Second Nature so we can listen to it while we talk. So I hear this term residency thrown around a lot, and I always assume that it just means you're living there, essentially, and I don't really know what that means. So you've been doing a residency at the Music Academy of the West. What are the responsibilities of a person who's doing a residency?
Well, it's quite a general term. It really does just mean that I'm here. But I think okay. That it allows for a deeper kind of connection to the fellows who are quite accomplished, but they're still students. Uh-huh. And I think that if you're going to make a difference in the way someone sings or plays or thinks about music or approaches mm-hmm. a particular kind of music, you can't just barge in one day and say, well, this is how I do it. You should do it that way too. You need to get to know, you know, not just their voice, but their spirit, you know, and their mind and the way that their body works, because, you know, singing especially is a really physical thing. Your instrument is inside of your body.
Right.
And so it's quite personal, and I think it would be wrong, especially working with young singers, to do anything but a residency if you want to actually get to know them.
Wow, that's so cool. So a residency essentially gives you the ability to really be with the people who are in that organization or in that company or wherever it is that you're working.
Sure.
And how does it sort of figure into your broader career? Like, what does a residency do for your career that, say, I don't know, just sort of being out in the world, being a composer, a conductor, working with various operas and symphonies, how is it different?
Well, you know, composing is a lonely business, but you know, there's no way around it. It's you and the empty page mm-hmm. or empty screen, if you prefer it that way. Yeah. The kinds of work I'm doing now are great because it does put a human face on a later stage in the process. That is the performance of the music. Mm-hmm. It's possible as a composer for that not to feel so personal, for it to be okay. I do my job. I sit alone in my desk, which, you know, presumably is on the top of an icy mountain somewhere in Siberia.
Right.
And then I send the music off and show up the week of the performance, and that's that. These kinds of residencies, you're right to notice the pattern. They are sort of defining my next couple of years. They allow me to engage with the people who will be playing my music and with whom I will be performing it at a much deeper level.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would make a distinction between these kinds of positions and the kind of job of, say, a music director or principal conductor of an mm-hmm. organization. Because if, in some cases, if one were to do that, there would be no time left for composing.
Yeah.
So these residencies strike a middle ground that makes me very happy.
I see. Wow. So it's a really, really unique opportunity. I'm interested, too. You kind of touched on, you know, you're working with people and getting to learn who the performers who are performing your music are. And you're coaching them, I'm assuming. And you, mm-hmm. but you yourself are a very young person in your field. You're 26, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
So, and a lot of the people at the festival are there in their early 20s. What's it like mm-hmm. to sort of be the authority figure amongst people who aren't that much younger than you? Like, what's that dynamic like?
It's a good question. I tend to feel that the age issue evaporates as soon as you start making music with someone.
Yeah.
Sure, the reality is that I'm on the faculty side and a lot of the fellows are on the, you know, all the fellows are on the student side. But in the moment of performing a piece, mm-hmm. those distinctions have to evaporate. I mean, I would be a terrible colleague if I were being, you know, pedantic or
right,
you know, intrusive in the moment of music making. So it's only a problem at the sort of social level and not at the level of the actual music because, you know, that always transcends those kinds of questions.
Yeah.
But, you know, in a coaching or a kind of masterclass situation, how to put it, young singers aren't stupid. They can smell BS a mile away, whether it's coming from someone who's 26 or 76.
Right.
So I really just have to do my best to offer substantial, real, honest feedback and see what happens.
So you just work at being your genuine self and hope for the best. And that's an interesting observation that when you're actually doing the music, which is the whole point of all of this, it kind of
evaporates.
Matter.
I mean, my job is in a weird way to make myself invisible, to inhabit the music so completely that no one is thinking about who the messenger is.
Right.
If I somehow were making it about me, mm-hmm. then people would start saying, "Hey, you know, whippersnapper." Whatever. But, you know, I hope that if we're all just making music, we're not thinking about the rest of our lives.
Right. How old someone is doesn't really play into making good music. That's yeah. Well, speaking of music, we're about to hear some of your opera, Second Nature. But before that, can you sort of set it up for us a little bit and tell me a little bit about the opera?
So Second Nature is it's a dystopian fairy tale, which is set about 100 years in the future. It was commissioned. It's by far the most specific commission I've ever written, commissioned by the Lyric Opera of Chicago as a small-scale chamber opera for five or six singers and three instrumentalists. And it had to be under an hour long. And the premiere was to take place in the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago.
Wow.
And when they approached me about writing the piece, Anthony Freud, the general director at Lyric, said, you know, it doesn't have to involve wildlife, but if you're inspired by the fact that it's going to first be heard in a zoo, you know, run with it.
Yeah.
So I visited the zoo, and you know, zoos are fascinating places. They're sanctuaries and prisons at once.
Right.
And they're both very hopeful places and very sad places because everywhere you go, you're hearing that the creatures in front of you are endangered mostly because of what we are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So wandering around this very beautiful zoo, my mind turned to what we're doing to the planet and all of that. So the piece is kind of a reverse Garden of Eden story set about 100 years in the future, in a future in which we've really screwed things up or, you know, continued
what we're doing currently. Yeah.
And the few remaining humans who've survived have kind of, they've been fleeing hurricanes and sandstorms and everything. And they've taken refuge in what was once a zoo. They've basically said, let us in, and built walls around themselves and hoped for the best.
Suddenly and suddenly, mankind didn't seem so tough. The rising tide of winters and harvest for the farmers. I must admit it felt like karma.
And it's about two kids. The opera is about two kids who were born into this world, having been fed all kinds of lies about why this is actually desirable, why this is actually the only way to live. And then the ape who lives next door, there's still an ape from back when it was a zoo, starts talking to them. He's been secretly growing a real tree, which is illegal. And the tree has been yielding fruit, and he offers the kids, who are a boy and a girl, offers them fruit, and they eat it, and it makes them realize that they have to get out of this place and see what there is out there in the world.
So this is what taste is. This is real fruit.
Not to dissect the frog of the story too much, but, you know, in the Garden of Eden, you want to be in the garden and the world outside is the punishment. But in this case, eating the fruit makes you realize you have to leave the garden. And maybe going out into the world is what you need to do if you're going to save it.
Yeah.
So it's a weird mixture of a parable and, you know, sci-fi and all told with my... you know, somewhat spiky, sometimes more lyrical, sometimes slightly edgier musical language. So it was interesting doing it at Music Academy for an audience. We did it twice. Once for an audience of about 400 kids from a nearby summer camp. And then we did it for an audience of adults. And I was totally nervous about doing it for all grown-ups because it wasn't really written for that kind of evening, you know, everybody's dressed up concert setting. But it, I don't know, the grown-ups may have liked it more. I'm not sure if that is a success or failure on my part.
So did you also write the libretto?
I did, yeah.
That's really awesome.
Thanks.
So can you tell me just briefly what is unique about participating in the Music Academy of the West Summer Festival as opposed to any other?
The Music Academy, of course, has a really strong history for singers, you know, from Lottie Lehmann through Marilyn Horne, through whose interest I got involved here at the Music Academy. But I think in recent years, the instrumental program has flourished in an astonishing way, so that really it's firing on all cylinders at the moment. I think the thing that sets it apart is the masterclass, which is a common enough concept now in the classical music world. You know, the masterclass being like a public lesson where a student plays something and a master teacher offers pearls of wisdom, hopefully in a way that is both useful to the student and interesting to an audience, you know, an audience of not just musicians. This has become very common, but what I didn't know until I came out here is that really the masterclass has its origins at this festival.
Really?
Wow. It's always been a really integral part. Long before the masterclass was the norm in the classical music world, it was an integral part of the way music gets taught here. And what I've been amazed about, you know, masterclasses, look, there's always the risk that it's going to be boring. Because if you listen, you know, if you're not a pianist and you listen to a piano teacher talking about, you know, fingerings for a particular piece, it might not be all that compelling. So when I think of a masterclass, I think of a hall that's almost totally empty and a teacher maybe mumbling and not being heard because the mic isn't working right, whatever. Uh-huh. Here, the masterclasses that I've attended have all been 100% sold out.
Wow.
And the audience here hangs on every word. Admittedly, the teachers here are really good at talking simultaneously to the student and to the audience because that's the culture of the place.
Yeah.
But what's really special is that the culture of the place extends to the audience.
Yeah.
And you have hundreds and thousands, really, of people who come back day after day, week after week. So that, for me, was really illuminating because I always find the teaching process to be every bit as exciting as watching a performance.
Yeah.
But I didn't necessarily think anybody else felt that way. So it's good to find an audience that does.
That's very cool. And my final question to you is, what do you do for fun while you're there in this gorgeous place?
Oh, man. Well, I'm a big runner and hiker.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, I'm still based in New York. But one of the major selling points, both of the Santa Barbara area and the LA area, is just the unbelievable quality of the hiking and the ease of just, you know, slipping out your front door and walking up a mountain. So I've been really enjoying that, escaping the campus every so often.
Awesome. Well, Matthew O'Coin, thank you so much for taking the time to come and chat with us in the Classical Classroom today. I know you've got a crazy busy schedule, particularly today, so I really appreciate your time.
Totally my pleasure, Daisha. Thank you for having me.
All right, everyone, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. You can follow us on all of the social media that you can find on that page. Let me try that sentence again in English. You can follow us on all the social media that you can find on that page. Send me an email at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. Subscribe to us, rate us, and review us on the iTunes. Thanks today to audio producer Todd, the bartered Todd Holslander, for making us sound nice. Thanks to editor Mark DiClaudio for his piercing metronome eyes. Thanks to Matthew O'Coin for being here today. Thanks to Kate Obriott over at Music Academy of the West for all of her incredible help with these episodes. Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.